This is the sort of system, but writ large and rather large, that I'm going to be principally talking about, systems which are just marginally solid. And I'm sorry, I didn't get that title, isn't the title I gave you, because I couldn't get into the network to check what title I had given the program. The other person who's had a big role in the work I'm going to tell you about is Raffi Blumenfeld, and also there are big acknowledgements to Sam Edwards, Dmitry Grinov, who was his student in Cambridge, Robert Farr, who was my student, and Colin Thornton, who had a big influence on me at the last ITP program in this area, and Don Melrose, who collaborated with me for a long time in Cambridge. And this is roughly the story I'm going to tell you. I'm going to introduce you yet again, I'm sorry, to this, what we call the marginally rigid state, but that's the same thing as the isostatic state. I'll show you the experimental evidence that we have that in one two-dimensional limit, we certainly do generate these states. And then talk about what we understand about stress transmission through these states in more quantitative detail. It turns out that you gain quite a lot of insight about what that means by thinking about going beyond the statics into yield. And you find there are interesting contributions from Graham Rowland. And then finally, there'll be some very woolly remarks about the possible differences between rough and smooth grain. This is just for, this meeting doesn't need this, but this is the sort of thing that people in the field worry about. Mountainsides collapsing, this is the famous rain silo problem here. That was originally one silo, two silos, three silos, and someone's gone to open this one, and whoop, down there. And you see the grain spilled everywhere, and this railroad car seems to have come to a sorry end as a result. Oh, well, I want that in a minute. But okay. So, here's this marginally rigid state. And the key idea is that if we have rigid grains, we start pushing them to build a tile. Well, they have a certain total number of degrees of freedom before they come into contact, translation plus rotation. As they make contacts, they acquire constraints. And the key argument is that if the grains are ideally rigid, the system will consolidate until such point as the number of constraints matches the number of degrees of freedom. And there is really no more in the argument than that. If the grains are not rigid, then of course it is possible for them to consolidate further than this. But they certainly must go at least this far. And then some more counting arguments. For every degree of freedom in the system, for the system to be stable at rest, there is precisely one condition of balance of a component of force or torque. And on the other side, for every constraint due to contact, there is in the solid assembly one component of intergranular force. And so if you've consolidated until these two match, you've consolidated to exactly the point where the number of conditions of force and torque balance is exactly right to determine all the intergranular forces. Also, a purely linear set of equations, just force balance. Of course, you can have accidents, right? The equations might and have degeneracy in them. They won't typically, but it can happen. But this then means typically that under this scenario, the static equilibrium conditions, just balancing forces and torques, determine all of the intergranular forces and hence all of the transmission of stress. So it's a very interesting case. You apparently do not need to consider the constitutive nature of your individual grains, as long as they're sufficiently rigid that they don't succeed in making extra contacts, generating extra constraints on the system. If they do that, then you've got to worry about the internal compliance of those grains, and all of the details of the material you built your granular pile out of then matter. Here's a partial score sheet on testing this idea. I'll show you in two dimensions. Per grain we have 3 degrees of freedom, and per contact, if we have friction, there are 2 constraints. You balance that up, you predict that the marginal mean coordination number per grain is 3, and I'll show you that one rather idealized experiment, we have a check of that. If there's no friction, then the debate's all the other way around. The marginal coordination number turns out to be 6, and in two dimensions, that's a topological maximum coordination number. So in two dimensions, it's impossible to get a system more than marginally rigid.
I'm sorry, maybe you said this already, but when you say no friction, you mean no frictional force, or the friction is static and holds?
Okay, so I am broadly speaking going to focus on 2 extreme limits. There is either infinite coefficient of static friction,
or zero coefficient
of friction, static or sliding.
And you did say that before, and I just
But there is, I will actually relax that at one point. Discs are a bit degenerate because in the absence of friction with a disc, it's impossible to deliver any torque to it. So frictionless discs are an anomalous case. They have marginal coordination number 4. The other thing that's interesting is that both of these values actually match what you get by sequential packing, as long as you unthink crystalline arrays of discs. Crystalline arrays of discs are an anomaly. They're an exact fit that just gives you more contacts than you rightly deserve. And in 3 dimensions, the story is qualitatively similar. With friction, the marginal coordination number is very low. It's 4. For frictionless particles, unless they're spherical, sorry about and discs, actually, and spheres, the value is high, it's 12, which is again what you could expect to achieve by sequential packing. In fact, that is no longer a topological maximum, but it is hard to exceed, but Boniff, Torcado, Chaikin and co. prove that there are arrays of ellipsoids that can give you 14. You have to try very hard, though. Okay. So now I want to show you these simple experiments, and there are some too possible to be PowerPoint, and that's just dubious. You know? So this is the experiment which we did. Almost literally, just replaced the OHP machine with a photocopier pattern. So we have here our particles. Those are the feed particles, and in a minute we're going to move this collector up into them. And if you think of life in the frame of reference of the moving collector, then the particles that are stationary on the platen are feeding down onto the pile. A key parameter in the experiment turns out to be the density with which we prepare the feed. And so now we send those particles into this momentumless analog of free fall. So we move the collector up, and you see we start to build a pile stationary in the frame of reference of the collector. But if you watch, you see that the disturbance propagates up rather further at any given moment than the consolidated pile. You also see a certain experimental problem there. Okay, and it reaches a point where it's built a stable pile. They're always nasty. No, here's an example of a redundant case. It's not really stable, we just happen to be loading it in the direction it's stable.
Robin, this is a way of creating packing at zero pressure.
It is not at zero pressure. In fact, as I'm preparing it, because these particles here have friction relative to the base. So whilst I'm at least advancing the collector, this pile is all under a loading, which is a quite close analogy to gravity.
Right, and then when you stop it, what happens?
Not a lot. Now, of course, the grains, they're a reasonable approximation to rigid. There are some gaps that you can see that aren't really gaps, because these particles of cardboard, they have a bit of fibrous spill around the edge, and the engagement of the fibres there helps to give a very large coefficient of sliding friction.
I'm just going to recall them chags.
No. Oh, yes.
If you pick up now your collector, just pick it up, lift it up off the slide, you now have a zero pressure packing.
Yeah, right here.
Maybe some elastic spun stored up.
Well, very, very little. I mean,
but there's no force from the outside, so the pressure must be zero.
Yeah. It's also a very accurately athermal system. And that KT is an utterly negligible quantity. Now, the only other point I want to make here is that if I space these out really generously, then the outcome is fairly obvious. It's an almost sequential packing, because you see that particles encounter the pile and largely sort themselves out before anything else intervenes. Although we seem to have built an interesting profile for the pile, surface profile in this case. So that's much of the detail of the experiment that we did, except you have to do it a lot of times. Disks tend to be bad news because they are so prone to crystallizing. So we used originally rather slightly kidney-shaped particles. That was a failed attempt to make an elliptical punch. And I've color-coded these to distinguish three different subspecies of the particles. The ones in blue are the feedstock. They are stationary with respect to the base. The ones in white are stationary with respect to the collector and have reached their final positions. And the ones in red are, as it were, still making up their minds. They have directly or indirectly encountered the pile or other particles in this red-coloured front, but they've not yet reached their endpoint positions relative to the base. That's a low-density feed. That's a medium density feed, and that's a high density feed. And if you can see the bottom left, if you just watch the sequence, what you'll see is that as we go up in the density of the feed, you'll see the pile becomes slightly more open. And here is that quantitatively. This is the final density of the pile as a function of the initial density of the feed. There is now some averaging over repeated experiments. And there's a gentle downwards trend. And qualitatively speaking, what that tells you is that as you go up in initial density, there's more and more interference between the particles, impeding their settlement into a high density local pocket.
Doesn't it depend on the rate how you do it, or do you always
assume
it's very slow?
We took care to do it slowly enough. And the observation is, apart from problems with unsteady hands, that you can stop and start, because the momentum and inertia are playing a negligible role in this experiment.
Adiabatic.
I hesitate to use the word adiabatic in a system that has so little conservative force in it. but I think in the sense you mean the word, yes. Now, So it's interesting that the way the trend of pile density is downwards as you increase the feed density, and that also implies a firm end point to the sequence of experiments. Not that we can do an experiment there, because there's no way you can grow a pile of density lower than your feed. And out of this we get a limiting end point, which is just below 50% here. Remember, this is two dimensions. They're not literally disks, but if you pack efficiently, you would expect to be able to get the order 90% and more. Right? So this is a very low packing density. Here's the coordination number measured by rather painful means. I think these are older data, so we have slightly better measurements, but the trend of the curve has not changed.
Actually, I'd like to criticize the upper curve. If you look at the rightmost 6 points, they're laying on a straight line, horizontal line, model of the experimental
that's resolution. Fair. Yes, but you're putting an awful lot of weight on 2 points.
2 out of 6.
I mean, clearly, yeah,
you're putting an awful lot of weight on one of
them. No, three. There's clearly a downward trend in the four leftmost points. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. But regarding...
Yes.
These are happening to different
experiments. They are, yeah.
How much scatter is there?
I think that these are probably four or five measurements. So the scatter on an individual one is quite big. It probably be twice that shape.
Also, be more useful to plot this curve between 0.4 and 0.6, so we can.
Well, you just can't do the experiment.
I mean, I think the y-axis.
That's 0.3. That's 0.4.
Y-axis.
Oh, that's the y-axis. Yes. Y-axis. Well, please, you do the experiment to function the x-axis.
The interesting thing actually is that the coordination number is clearly going down for those points, yet the density is pretty flat.
It's pretty flat, that's really the point. Now here's the coordination number. This scale runs from 3 at the bottom to 4 at the top. And the trend here is, thank you Thomas, indisputably down. And now the starting point that you would have predicted that in the limit of zero density this was sequential deposition, and you ought to get the value of sequential packing, namely 4. You don't quite, but when you do the experiment it's very clear why, and that's that there's occasional you see events where one particle comes down but it destabilizes the pile already there. All on its own, it destabilizes things. And it's we think, those events which are just pulling that coordination number down in that region. What about here? Well, the fact that we have a fairly confident extrapolated endpoint for the sequence of experiments means that we then have a corresponding endpoint to the sequence of coordination number, and that's at around 3.1. That's measured.
You have used in your collector a rather weighty button.
It was a bit, for the disks, for the actual experiments it was rather flatter because we didn't have disks. Disks are terribly prone to crystallizing. I mean, we originally abandoned disks because of problems with crystallization.
I mean, you're approximate to a dimensionality which is one dimension, where you always get the marginally rigid state for rotating particles.
I don't see where you're coming from in saying these experiments are one-dimensional.
I say you're approximate to it. What I'm saying is that you look at this 3.1 and you say, well, it's awfully close to 3. If you look in three dimensions, we were getting numbers like 4.3.
Okay.
So that suggests that actually, as you go up in dimensionality, this marginal rigidity approximation is getting worse and worse.
Well, it's all right. If we really push, if you want to push the details about point one, because our particles are very slightly kidney shaped, it is possible to get cases where two grains touch at two points. The incidence is low, but where it happened, we counted it. So there's a case for those who can see. I'm sorry, this podium gets in the way. There's a case there, two grains that definitely touch twice. That's a doubtful. Oh, there's a nice one. There are not very many of them, but if you count them up, you can work out how that corrects thing. It actually would. It does quantitatively cause the point one. Now.
So are you saying that if you counted these double contacts as one, you would end up...
Well, the trouble is the double contacts are really only worth three constraints, whereas naively you would say four. Point is if two particles touch once, touch twice, you have removed one translation, you've removed one rotation and one sliding mode. You remove 3 degrees of freedom, not four. So now we counted the double contacts as two contacts,
not one and a half.
But if you do count them one and a half, then 3.1 comes down to three.
That. I mean, the issue is how many forces are inserted into the contacts. The number of degrees of freedom, you know. The number of forces that are exerted across the contacts could be two times the number of forces that are exerted across one contact.
The two tangential determinants.
Yeah.
One, there's a tangential force that can determine the two particles touching twice.
I don't understand that statement.
Well, just put two particles together. Now, open this contact. Pull this that way, push that one that way, and then close the contact again.
Right.
The external geometry is the same. As long as that's held in compression, there's a tangential force there and a counterforce there, which are all to do with this rearrangement and play no role in the external force of stress transmission. And so that's a wasted constraint. Could we come back to that at the end?
I don't understand.
No. But,
Another question. I just want to make sure I understand. So you said that the possibility that one particle comes down the pile and destabilizes something. So presumably this has to do with the drag force and the question whether cracking is zero pressure or not. Right? So there is somehow another variable here is how fast you're moving your collector.
Well,
and you're supposedly doing
this,
it.
I believe the experiment. I believe the experiment to be well posed in the slow moving limit, when everything that's moving is under sliding friction and everything that's not moving is under static friction.
But you want to take the limit of zero velocity.
Yes, but what I'm saying is we're well into that limit.
Except when you see one particle collapsing the pile, that would seem like...
No, that can happen purely under the frictional forces. One particle coming down can frictionally load another particle in a way that pushes it into sliding.
That's what I mean, but
that's
all friction depends on frictional load depends on how fast you're moving a collector.
Not in the limit of slow motion, no. Frictional forces in the slow motion are velocity independent. We're not talking about Stokes drag. Okay. Now the other interesting thing that you can focus on in these experiments, which I think you can interpret as elevating the status of the isostatic state, is this front region that we have, in which where the pile is being organized. Now, this is a sequence not with time, but with feed density. So low density of feed, there's very little front, medium density becomes more extensive across the surface, and as you go to higher densities, it starts really becoming thick. And indeed, you can see that we, in these early experiments, we quite rapidly just run out of spatial range in the experiment. Here the front is already a significant fraction of the total sample. So this is a candidate diverging length scale in the problem. And here are the quantitative measurements of that. This is the front measured as a mass, as a number of grains per unit length of the base, all made dimensionless in terms of the grain size. But qualitatively speaking, this is the thickness of the front in grains. As a function of the ratio of the initial feed density to the final density of the pile. So the end point of this plot would ultimately be unity.
Sorry, would you mind just saying again how the front is defined physically?
It's the set of grains whose position matches neither their initial position in the frame of the feed nor their final position in the frame of the pile.
So you kind of reconstructed.
You have a snapshot at the start of the experiment, you have a snapshot at the end of the experiment, and then you overlay an intermediate snapshot and compare to both of those. And everything that doesn't match either the start or the finish is in the front.
It's an interesting speculation that this length scale might diverge as rows divide over rows 2 goes to 1. But I doubt that you're really claiming that you've observed evidence for that.
Well, here's the data. Okay? Such as that's the raw data. So it's getting up towards the 7 grains, and we hit limitations on how far we can take.
That's based on one point. And one point with enormous error bars. And in fact, at one point with error bars substantially larger than the points around it.
Yes, that is true. This is a very painful experiment. All the data taking was done by hand. So if it's true that you would like better data, but the number of man hours going into getting this data is already large. Here is the same data, rather optimistically, put on a log-log plot, the log of the front mass versus the log of something proportional to the density deficit. And the data up here is consistent with a power law minus one divergence. Thomas is absolutely right that the evidence is not all that strong. You shouldn't worry too much about the points down here, because the points down here, the front is essentially sub-monolayer, and those points don't mean very much. There is a theoretical argument that suggests a minus one power. Would someone know how to get the board light on?
The switch is right there.
So we have one speed at which the base is advancing, and then here's the front, in general moving at a higher speed, and it's a trivial shockwave argument to show that the velocity of the front varies as 1 over the density difference between the pile and the feed. That's just concept. You just look at the problem in frame of reference as a front, and you conserve material and get material out. And what we would like is a handle on how wide that front is. There is a residence time for grains in the front. Let's call that T front. That's clearly on the order of the front width divided by the front speed. And then this question, how far does a grain move in that residence time? Because it's the grain motion while it's in the front that's got to deliver it from the feed configuration to the pile configuration. And the grains are never going to individually move significantly faster than the speed of the base. So the particle motion is on the order of, or less than, the base t front. And so this then is down by one speed ratio, and we may as well make that dimensionless. If you do it naively, that turns out to be a little higher, I think, on the top there. These are very similar, so it doesn't matter. So this is proportional to V base over V front, if I got that the right way around, times C. Now, if the key question is, how far does a grain need to move in going from being in the feed to being in the pile? And the key argument here is that the densities at which we're seeing the end of the experiment are nowhere near limits of packing. If you look at typical nearest neighbor distances in the feed, they're still of order particle dimensions. So if you insist that this distance is on the order of a particle size, then you immediately conclude from that the front width should diverge, or should follow the divergence of the front velocity. Pardon?
Can you directly
measure delta R? Well, I'm assuming A to be of order of particle size.
No, I mean, can you directly measure delta R?
We have not done so. But when you watch the things, it does appear to be of order of grain size. There's no, you can't see any evidence that it's getting smaller.
It's a big question. I mean, if it's in a steady state, why is energy B not the same as we have?
This is a standard propagation.
In a steady state of a long time?
No.
No.
Because these densities are different. The mismatch of these densities forces these front to be different from these base. Can we figure that out? Because that really is a standard result. And so on that basis, this would go like delta rho to minus 1.
I mean, the solid front does not move at the same speed as the electric.
So that's why we were particularly interested to check a minus 1 power law.
Well, why is that a box when you said that isn't that exactly the VF?
There are issues of which frame of reference you're using, but since VF is much bigger than any of the other blocks.
You've seen that the
width
of the shops are going to vary, then it should be exact.
Well, it's exactly, just to be a bit careful about which frame of reference you're competing with. That's the only, the bigger,
that actually raises an interesting question. How strong is the evidence that the width of the red region is not changing as a function of time?
We're between a rock and a hard place there, in that it's reasonably constant where it's small enough that you've got a good dynamical range. The further you go up in front size.
The thing about soliton physics, Robin, is that getting a soliton that doesn't disperse with time is actually kind of hard if you just start with a random equation of motion.
Well, the question is how.
Well, hold on just a minute. If you're beginning to assert the scenario that this front width might actually diverge with time. That would still be an interesting outcome. But we're essentially...
If I were going to, put money on this, I would say it would increase diffusively the time, something like that.
I think it is hard for it to do that because you then get very tenuous connected pieces here, and those are very prone to collapse. This sort of thing, rapidly, very, very prone to collapse. Right? That grain, when that hits it, that's going to collapse that long.
The question is about the vacuum, which goes that as the pressures, because the situation is not homogeneous and the pressure increases further back, how long can you define the vacuum? Because you still get some movements further down in the pile.
Yes, you.
The Fontex might be very well, it's probably very well defined, but the vacuum could be much less so.
That's a fair comment. Experimentally, that's what we meant. I can't really say more than that.
Robin, since you're being pressed on statistical issues here, can you comment on whether this could be done maybe better numerically?
You mean as a simulation?
Yes, as a simulation. Oh. You get a lot of statistics and you could really...
Indeed, although those who... done such simulations, I think there are people in the room will point out to you that the equations are not trivial equations to solve. You've got to decide what's rigid and what's locked and what's not, and then you have quite a lot of
local. You can do a contact dynamics. I mean, doing kidney shaped particles is a nuisance, but if you want to do contact dynamics with frictional, circles. Okay. I mean, that's perfectly feasible. And one could rapidly answer all of these questions that we've spent 40 minutes speculating about.
But you have to use, I believe, some DEM, and then the computational complexity...
Of why do you have to use DEM if you're just in contact dynamics with this?
No, for ellipsoids.
Is Robin claiming that the physics of this is fundamentally controlled by the fabric?
If you have to use the ellipses, you can't use contact dynamics.
I'm saying, why not just use circles?
Polydisperser.
I just feel awkward because you've got to intervene. You've got to do something to prevent crystallization, but polydisperser you will do.
I didn't understand that remark about having to use discrete element methods. Because any particle, no matter what the shape, can be represented by a center of mass position at one angle.
Yeah,
it ought to be easier than that.
I think in practice, you're probably right, Jerry. It's just people shied away from that problem of writing algorithms for when are two kidney-shaped particles, for instance, in contact.
No, I think the kidney is special because it has multiple contacts, but an ellipsoid would be...
Yeah, ellipsoid would be fine, and in fact, I skipped over the fact that some of these, there are actually two data sets here, a second data set with ellipsoids rather than kidney, with true ellipsoids rather than kidney shape. Yeah.
But the right way to do it is probably polydisperser.
The other thing is, I think what's coming up here actually the dynamics of this prompt. Dynamical measurements appear to be a very interesting question that emerges from this experiment.
You mean what happens at finite velocity? Is that what you mean?
Well, what is the, I mean, whether
it's what the kinematics, what's the kinematics of
it? Yeah, whether it's translation or whether you're spreading, if you see the broadening of the format.
I mean, if you watch the experiment, as Jim said, there is an issue about the back edge of the front, but there's no real issue about the front edge of the front. Right?
You mean it's evident that it really expands, but is that what you mean, no issue?
It can't, the front edge of the front can't disperse that. It just isn't going to happen if you watch the experiment. But the back edge, Jim is right, that there are issues about the back edge.
Well, the issue about the front edge is it's not whether it exists, but whether it, but how it, what its velocity is.
So there's a supersonic shock, I mean, so there's nothing
happening
in front.
There's still an issue there.
Oh, and as long as the front width saturates, then this argument becomes rigorous.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, if you write down any, broadly speaking, Berger-sized equation for this front, you're going to find that unless you are very careful about what you write down, the typical thing that happens is the front grows diffusively.
Yes, but having spent many hours and roughly more hours doing the experiment, I think we would say that's a problem with Berger's equation. How much more time do you want to give me? Because we've had the first quarter of the talk.
Well, we're not bored yet, I don't think.
Robin, is large and small the two samples?
No, it's simply that these are the smaller experiments that we did, and you can see we're just running out of dynamical range. We're running out of there's not enough grain width there. So I did some more experiments with twice as many grains. So they were smaller. They were too small for it to be practical to count coordination number, and too many for it to be practical to count coordination number. But the front measurement is more straightforward, and so that's the difference between the squat, the sitting down triangles are relate to those data series. The upright triangles are, no, the other way around. The upright triangles are those series, the sitting down triangles are the series with more smaller grain.
But, you know, before we leave this slide, we should note the action item for the program, which is we have plenty of people coming in and out of Santa Barbara who have contact dynamics. So it was also to mention, so we could do this pretty quickly.
Yes, please.
But something different, right? The system is not controlled by doing this screen.
No. Really friction.
In any case, you have to modify it.
Well, ellipsoids is fine. Kidney shape was just an annoyance because how do you make making an ellipsoidal punch out the particles? It's not so easy.
The real numeric challenge is that you have to go to large number of particles. And in contact dynamics, you can do this 10,000 particles at most, but not more.
Yeah. So you'll get
10,000 looks like a lot more than
you'll get. 10,000 would be one. We've gone to about
10,000 is a right optimistic estimate.
We've gone to 300. Okay, but that still beats us by a factor of 30. So, I might be tempted to try and do a bigger experiment as well.
Yeah, we do with Gary Gress has done up to about 100,000.
The other.
No, spheres.
The other big bonus of doing a contact dynamic simulation is that the hard part of the simulation, deciding who's in contact with whom, will give you the payback of really knowing what the coordination numbers are. I don't want to go into the details long enough, but it is a technical problem in these experiments. What I'd like to come on to is what is known or thought about the problem. The equations of stress transmission through these marginally rigid or isostatic assemblies, where we know microscopically what the equations are. They just consist of balancing force and torque on each particle, but what you would like is a more macroscopic continuum version, upscaled from that. And the most trivial cases that you can solve which are periodic arrays and the particles with friction. We need coordination number 3 in 2 dimensions. So the simplest thing you can build is topologically a honeycomb lattice, but the honeycomb lattice has 2 grains per unit cell, and so I'm taking care to take the chance to make them distinct. And if you solve the stress transmission on these systems, what you end up with, if you're careful, is a set of just linear homogeneous equations on the stress tensor. And in the general dimension, you've got a set of coefficients here, which have got 4 indices, 2 anti-symmetric and 2 symmetric contracted on those stress tensor. The other equations, this comes about through balancing torque. You've got 2 grains per unit cell, that's 2 conditions of torque balance. One goes to making the stress tensor symmetric, and the other gives you that.
Does the stress tensor have to be symmetric in such a system?
If you define it on a unit cell basis, then yeah.
But not in a continuum on a larger scale,
huh? I don't want to get too embroiled in Casera media, but if you want to keep things simple, then yes. In the continuum limit, yes. Now, if you go down to the grain level, you start being sensitive to exactly what force moments you use to define the stress tensor, and then you can get a different thing. Here's just the... Just for completeness, some gory details, these fourth rank tensors have certain unpleasant features, namely that if you calculate, we've got two types of grain per unit cell, and you'll get exactly equal and opposite values for this tensor if you compute around one species of grain or the other. So the spatial average is strictly zero in the periodic arrays, and you can to some extent generalize this off lattice in two dimensions. When you do that, you still find a very strong anti-correlation between these tensors for nearest neighbor grain, and again the spatial average is strictly zero. But you've got to define centers for the voids, centers for the grains, you've got to identify the contacts, and then we have vectors little r spanning from contact to contact, vectors big R, grain center to void center, and you can build this tensor out of those vectors with an awful lot of rearrangement of indices from antisymmetric tensors there. That's two dimensions, three dimensions is just worse. But zooming out, the important thing is this does appear to put us in the category of locally linear constitutive equations, and these have got a lot of history. Ordinary simple linear is what the Cates group first called them. I think I'm probably wrong to put isostatic there, but certainly it was in the early days just associated with this case. And one subclass which has had a lot of influence, fixed principal axes, is where none of these tensors couples to the trace of the stress tensor.
Excuse me, if I understand what you just said, for the case where you are hyperstatic, there is no such equation as satisfied by the stress tensor. In fact,
if you are hyperstatic, that means you're more than marginally coordinated, then no, you've got no such.
So in fact, it is somewhat fair to say that linear relation, using linear relations of this type to determine the stress tensor, is tied fundamentally to the proposal of isostaticity.
Yes, all right, but there's a reservation coming about that. Fixed principal axes is a case which has had a lot of influence. It's the one that Cates group focused on years ago, and as I say, that's where the trace of the stress tensor does not couple into these equations. So it's just a special case where these P tensors are traceless in their right-hand pair of indices. In two dimensions, the fourth rank character is degenerate because, of course, there's only a one unique anti-symmetric second rank tensor, and so you can reduce this just to a second rank, just one equation here. And here's Tichenko and Whitman's version of the same. You can just write the inverse of that and write the stress tensor as multiples of two elementary tensors. All of these descriptions have some equivalence between them. We made an attempt to look at the stability under a simple real space renormalization group as follows. So here's one subblock, and we say, well, it's got its P tensor, and it's obeying P contracted with sigma equal to zero. And here's a second block, it's got a different P tensor, and in general a different stress tensor. We ignore inhomogeneity of the stress across these blocks, and then when we stick them together, just matching the force transmitted across the boundary gives you this constraint on sigma prime and sigma double prime. And then you can build out of that a joint condition relating a new renormalized P tensor and the volume average stress.
What is little n?
The vector normal to the joining surface. And in two dimensions, it turns out that's relatively straightforward to carry out. In this case, the P tensors just have two indices, and it's just the most particular. the renormalized P tensor is a particular linear combination of the two input ones. In each case, you scale them so they're transverse components. That's the doubly this way component is normalized to unity. So it's a pseudo linear combination. If you can two dimensions in three dimensions, it's very ugly because this thing PTT is itself not a scalar. What comes out of this? Now, let's be careful here. If you're putting plate, in principle, one looks for fixed points in the space of distributions of P tensors. That's a very big space, and it is not easy to explore it completely. Here are the easy classes of fixed point to spot. Firstly, constant fixed points, where P is any constant. That's a perfectly sensible case for smooth grains, where you do not get these frustration effects. You can define a P tensor for an individual grain in a smooth, marginally rigid assembly, which does not stationally average to zero between mu and haven. But the significance for rough grains is unclear because the way they average to zero at the grain level. Then there are pressureless fixed points. These are very robust. This is where one of the Pij, etc., constrains the stress to be traceless. And that's a clearly transitive property under the stress combination. That is, if you combine two traceless stresses, the result is a traceless stress. It's linearly stable to fluctuations in two dimensions. But distressingly, that is completely incompatible with cohesionless granular matter. If the stress tensor is traceless, then at least one of the principal stresses must be positive. And that's unsustainable by a cohesionless material. I'm using this stress sign conventions rather than pressure sign conventions.
And how is it seen numerically?
But we can grind the RG equations, you know, without asking whether things break. And then the fixed principal axes fixed points.
The point is the fixed point curve appears, but you've written linear equations, not exactly bothering about the fact that there are nonlinear constraints on the forces.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, fixed principal axes condition is also transitive, because if all the input P's are traceless with respect to the right-hand indices, then that property is trivially seen to be inherited. They appear to be neutrally stable with respect to a small bit of coupling to the isotropic path in two dimensions. The indication in three dimensions is moot. If anything, they may be slightly unstable. But in two dimensions, with this crude RG, there is some sign, some hope for stability. But that's as far as we've taken those RG calculations, and I think as far as they're worth. The problem is the crudity of the real space RG. But what I'd like to just mention at this point is thinking in a Landau theory type mode, what more generally is the constitutive equation, you might wish to consider adding gradient terms. So fundamentally, we've come from force balance conditions. With fixed geometry, the equation should be strictly linear in the stress tensor, but then you can entertain the possibility of a gradient expansion. And you worry, what is the leading non-zero differential order?
Shouldn't any stress tensor, if this really worked, shouldn't any stress tensor that was inside the Moore Coulomb cone be a fixed point?
We were not talking about stress, the renormalization of the stress tensors, but of the P tensors.
Okay.
The P tensors are constitutive. They exist.
The fixed points of the P tensors determine the possible values of the stress tensor.
Correct.
And that's why you're using properties of the stress tensor such as pressure.
Hold on. They don't determine the stress tensor. They constrain it.
Right.
It's determined along with force balance and the condition of the symmetry.
But that's why you were using properties like having a pressure or being pressureless of the stress tensor to describe these various fixed points that are fixed points of the P's. Nevertheless, you probably believe that even in an isostatic packing, there is a class of stress tensors that is possible. And
given,
in fact, that it is...
Given by this. So far we've just discussed the first term.
No, there's a class of homogeneous stress tensors, non-spatially varying stress tensors that are possible, that is of measure one on, you know, the appropriate stress tensor space and is bounded by fundamentally nonlinear constraints on the problem. Therefore, the whole language of fixed points seems off.
Let me just carry on a little bit, and we can discuss that more meaningfully. What for periodic aspherical rough grains, provided we pick a sign convention on this anti-ferromagnetic pattern of the P's, we can identify a non-zero P tensor. But that is a staggered order. And the moment you lose a nice orderly array, it's not clear how macroscopically you would pick a sign convention over the stagger. So you then have to face up to the possibility that you'll start looking at higher terms. There's another way in which the P tensor vanishes, and that's if you use still a periodic array, but spherical grains. In that case, you find the P tensor, even after noticing the staggered pattern, the P tensor is still zero, and the first case which is non-zero is Q. Now, if this is the first non-zero term, then you are indeed correct that this constitutive relation says that any uniform sigma is supported. So it depends where this constitutive relation starts. If the grains are aspherical in a periodic array, what this is really telling you is that some uniform stresses lead to unbalanced torques on some grains. If the grains are spherical, that doesn't happen. And so the first term in this relation is first order one. If the system, if you really give up and you say the system is statistically isotropic and homogeneous, I missed that out, then you are forced to dismiss the P tensor. Q, since it seems it's associated with something with odd parity, seems likely to be zero, and it then appears that you might have to conceive of starting at this second order term. Smooth grains, on the other hand, are quite different. You can have a periodic array of aspherical grains in which each grain has a non-zero average p-tensor. So that there's the possibility, from the point of view of the static constitutive equation, that the rough grains and smooth grains might be fundamentally different.
Can I ask a question?
Chairman says you can.
I mean, if you thought about what's the kind of thing you would really like to be able to compute? One of the things you would like to be able to compute would be, from a microscopic coefficient of friction between the particles, compute what the coefficient of internal friction is, which is a macroscopic quantity, which would appear in Coulomb's failure law, more Coulomb failure law for the system. So, how would you use this in order to...
I'm going to show you more of that.
Because I guess it was completely, because of the way you set up the conversation about the RG, it wasn't clear to me how you would actually use it to determine nonlinear properties like that.
Well, what what I'm going to do now, I'm going to, for the moment, abandon this discussion about higher order gradient constituent equations and just focus on the P sigma equals zero limit. And try to understand what that P sigma equals zero means. And so let's just ask ourselves about yield conditions in these periodic arrays. It's very easy to cook up a macroscopic yield condition. These arrays have got built-in slip planes, and you just apply a Moore Coulomb condition for sliding failure at one of these contacts, the array being periodic. That means that you can get failure across a whole plane. So that's the shear force on one of these contacts. That's the normal force on one of these contacts. And if you exceed that condition, then that contact should slip. So this then can be folded into a plastic yield function, y of sigma. You just take a product over those conditions, and then if that product exceeds zero, then you put the thing into a yielding condition. The creeping yield condition would be that y equals zero, and of course y negative, it would be unyielding and static. So we can build a yield function such that y equals zero is a creeping yield or plastic flow locus. And so then, here is what the plastic flow equations look like. Here's the symmetric part of the deformation rate. In general, if the system is sliding, then there are certain directions, polarizations of slide it's allowed, depending on where and which bit of the yield locus it sits. In plastic flow, there's an undetermined, an as yet undetermined, scalar free factor of how fast it's yielding in a given region. And then what I want to argue is that in general we have some extra terms there, and I've anticipated that they're very closely related to the P tensors we've already met, but for the moment they're just a new set of coefficients coupled to grain angular velocity. Now, before you complain that we're violating Galilean invariance, it's clearly got to be the case, if these things come in, that their spatial average will be zero. It's got everything to do with rough grains, yeah? I just want you to note that's one symmetric tensor's worth of equations, so that's enough equations to determine their stress tensor's worth. We have to supplement that by, well, firstly, the condition that we're on the yield locus. That's one scalar equation. That's enough to determine an A's worth. We have the condition of force balance. That's one vector's worth of equations. And finally, we are in trouble. We need one extra equation, and that one extra equation would be our constituent equation P sigma equals zero. That's one angular velocity's worth of equations. And now we've got enough equations to determine the stress tensor, the sliding rate, the velocity field, and the grain angular velocity. So we've got a well-posed set of equations. And notice that I can only get to a well-posed set of equations if I bring in these extra terms coupled to the angular velocity. If I don't do that, I'm caught in a tangle which did come up in earlier discussions, namely that I will have difficulty both being on the yield surface and being close to the static solutions. I need extra terms in order that I can simultaneously obey the constitutive relation whilst the system is yielding.
And I have a fundamental problem with this, which is that I'm not aware in actual flows.
This is a creeping system, not a flowing system.
Okay. It's not clear to me that flowing systems are actually on the yield surface in random or matter.
No, I don't think they would be.
What is the difference between creeping and rolling? Except a matter of degree.
In my terminology, creeping does involve mobilizing friction.
Creeping involves
sliding. we have put contacts into slide.
Is creeping the same as rolling at the limit of rolling at small velocity?
No, because we're saying, no, oh, sorry, it's not coming back. In order to creep, we have induced slip at the contact.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
I mean, the problem is that, for instance, in the chute flow simulations, you can go arbitrarily slowly and have states with arbitrarily low free volume, which are not on the yield surface.
What does that mean in plain English?
Do you think the momentum is arbitrarily negligible?
Well, you know, what that means is, I almost pose this as an unsolved problem last week. If you look at flows typically have very small anomalous normal stresses. So they're like hydrodynamic fluid, you know, ordinary Navier-Stokes fluid, you know, water flows, in the sense that the stress in the direction of flow is almost the same as the stress in the gradient direction. That is not the case in classic Moore Coulomb yield, where those stresses are significantly different from one another. So it appears that there is a fundamental incompatibility in the stresses that prevents yield being a continuous transition, which I think is kind of implied by what Ron was talking about.
Right. Can I just keep where I am? I've introduced these extra terms, essentially a contribution of grain rolling to the overall creeping motion. And the question is, how is that tensor related to the previous key tensor? There's one explicit calculation which you can do. Just take one of these grains, rotate that grain, and without rotating the others. Co-translate them such that rolling conditions are honored, and ask them what deformation rate you induce in this neighborhood. And if you do that calculation explicitly, then you get out of this calculation geometrically exactly in two dimensions, exactly the same tensor as occurred in the static force balance equation. So this is an explicit calculation showing you that the coupling of grain rolling to macroscopic symmetric deformation is governed by exactly the same tensor that occurs in the force balance equation. There's also a more macroscopic instrument that leads to the same conclusion, and Tuchenko and Witten, I think, said something similar to this, and that's just to calculate the rate of dissipation. So you just contract the strain rate tensor with the stress tensor. Yeah. We get one term from the sliding and a second term from the rolling. But then, of course, you would like it to be the case that rolling does not give you any explicit dissipation. You would like all the explicit dissipation to have come from the sliding. But here, we've got... Now, look at the way this has happened. If we put this in... This has come from a term omega p as a contribution to the shear rate tensor. But when you make this contraction, you see, looking at it the other way, you've got p on sigma again. And so you see quite literally that this term p sigma is the force conjugate to grain rolling. And we could have got these coefficients of p, not from force balance, but just from the plastic flow equations. And I think in general that might be a better way to think of where they come from. If you insist that that these terms are not directly dissipative, then you're forced to conclude P sigma equals zero.
I don't understand what's the physics of saying that those are not directly dissipative.
I've got to be careful here, because it was argued earlier that in fact the rolling of one rigid particle over another does entail some dissipation.
Except in the limit of infinite coefficients.
Yeah. But in the limit of infinite rigidity, instant friction, then rolling is a non-dissipative process. That's how railway trains work.
All right. cars. I understand, but I also understand that it's not quite right.
Better approximation for trains than it is for cars.
It's good for our
research. That's true.
So if you say that rolling is not directly dissipative, then you're forced to conclude that P sigma should be zero, and that's brought us all the way back to that.
Yeah, it's not quite right.
So it all fits together, and I've got to credit these guys with said this. What I've said so far has promoted enough discussion, and I want to come back to this issue really of rough versus smooth grain. And raise the question, what happens when you attempt to load a sample in a manner that's incompatible with P sigma equals zero? So you loaded it up, it was sitting happy, its geometry was matched to its stress, and then you change the external loading. Now, two things can happen, of course. You can play around with the loading on the surface, but what you get delivered into the bulk is another matter. The other possibility is that the P tensors can change and jointly deliver a change in conditions in the bulk. And what I want to suggest to you, and just on the basis of pictures, it's an idea to be pursued, that there's maybe a fundamental difference, that in the smooth grain case, the imposed deformations penetrate the bulk, so the bulk really deforms and the P tensors in the bulk really reorganize. Whereas for rough grains, any strain you induce is disproportionately concentrated at the walls. You get rearrangement at the walls until it succeeds in transmitting to the bulk loads compatible with the original bulk constitutive equation. And I just want to do this at the level of pictures. Here's a cartoon of what happens if you try to compress a smooth grain picture in this direction. You let it, of course, correlate in this direction, and they can trivially reorganize, and you can make that a bigger array, and you can see that it will just do that on a bigger scale. There's no frustration in what's going on. If, on the other hand, you look at the arrays of rough grains, and you ask, well, how can I squeeze this thing along this direction, allowing expansion that way, without slip, then focus on that grain at the moment. If that grain rotates clockwise and that rotates anti-clockwise, then those two get closer together. This will have been swung up here, but you can rotate it all the way back down to here and bring it closer to that one. This will have been swung a terrible amount, so you need an even bigger counter-rotation to bring this grain back to where you want it. And the rotations you need to deliver this compression get bigger and bigger as you go outwards from the centre of the sample. You have a similar situation going on if you watch what's happening. If you've rotated this one, then you need to counter-rotate that one, and you find that you again have increasing strains as you go this way. And so all your deformations are disproportionately delivered to the region around the walls. If you look at pure shear, then if you, with a staggered sign convention, if you have an angle of rotation theta, then essentially the local shear you get is proportional to the gradient of theta. But if you track this all the way up to the wall can't rotate. It can only slide. It can only shear. And the amount of shear you deliver in the wall region isn't proportional to the local gradient of theta, but proportional to theta. So in all these problems with counter-rotating rigid grains, you deliver disproportionate strains to the wall regions. And that then suggests that if you try to force the system to reorganize without actually slipping, it will disproportionately reorganize around the walls where you're in a position to manipulate the loads, leaving its bulk essentially unchanged. But I've got no further equations to back that up. That's really an issue to be pursued. So let me end at this point I think many of these issues have been picked up, but where do we stand? Direct experimental evidence for building isostatic states in two dimensions in this rather idealized momentumless, inertialess experiment. Yes, I agree, it would be nicer to take it much further, and simulation does appear to be the way. To do this experimentally in three dimensions is outstanding, as far as I know. coordination numbers are not easy to measure. The theory of stress transmission, we've got a certain amount of empirical theory, but we would desperately like to have calculations in three dimensions which escape the special case of a lattice. RG gives some hope that fixed principal axes, which I should have said has been used by, to great effect by the Cates group in predicting load distributions in the piles, might be stable. But that conclusion is only as good as a rather poor renormalization group, and one would really like to do that in a manner which was clearly susceptible to systematic improvement. I flagged up the question of what the constitutive equations really are. These ordered arrays could be seriously misleading us, and I suspect that it may be that the correct continuum description has explicit gradient has gradient terms at leading order. It is interesting that all the statics can be taken across and reinterpreted back through a plastic yielding hydrodynamics. It gives you also a new interpretation of dilatancy. Well, I say new, it reinforces an old interpretation of dilatancy in that for these samples, in order to be able to shear, the particles require to roll, and in order to roll, the sound system has to dilate. From this point of view, one sees very explicitly that the new static equations that one finds for the constitutive behavior of the isostatic state are directly relate to the forces conjugate to grain rolling. What I really have left totally open is if you bought into this whole picture, how you would close the evolution of the system with an evolution equation for these constitutive tensors. That's the bit where all this discussion leaves open. It says these tensors are determined by the geometry, but then how does the geometry relate to how you prepared the sample? And can you achieve a closure at the level of these tensors rather than all of the microscopic geometry? In doing that, I suspect that you'll find that rough and smooth grains may be fundamentally different. And then finally, what none of this has done, as far as I know today, is there any impact on engineering soil mechanics or the real world. Okay, thanks a lot. But there are some papers.
You distinguish between rough and smooth grains. It's a very interesting distinction, but is it a meaningful distinction, or is the notion of smooth grains a singular limit which can never be really satisfactorily investigated?
It's not a bad description of emulsions. Right?
Okay, that's a good point.
Emulsions. Emulsions, yeah. You can get
droplets and fluids.
Yeah. Also, of course, if you have low, well-lubricated, low-friction particles, it's possible to get into a regime where you have loaded the system up quite enough to immobilize friction and yet mobilize sliding whilst not significantly deforming your particles. So I think in practice you can get into that limit.
But I'm sorry, are you saying you can do it for dry granular materials also or not?
Well, they have to have some lubrication.
Yeah, I see.
Well, you've got to get the low coefficient of friction somehow. But I mean, there are materials with very low coefficients of friction available. I don't think there's any fundamental obstacle.
I mean, is 0.01 low enough? 0.01 is that low enough?
I would have said so, because to get
in other words, with 0.01 you should see a significant difference between bulk and interior.
To get these experiments to work, we did it initially with bits of cardboard. We then tried to get smart. We tried to use really well-defined particles, cut out of plastic, a fine plastic foam, in fact. It was hopeless. The piles would collapse because of slide. The coefficient of sliding friction for these particles against each other is in the ballpark 50 to 100. Very high.
So these are rough?
Oh, they're locally rough because of the fibrous nature of car.
Yes, but so you're saying that in practice, so these are rough particles, but it's the smooth ones that I'm...
Yes, what I'm saying is that to get into the almost ideally rough particle limit, we have to use a very high coefficient of friction. So I turn it round, you see, and say that, well then...
smooth is easy, then, is what you're saying.
Smooth, I think, is really quite quite accessible, yeah. It's getting into the ideally rough, which is the hard bit. And getting the right grain to do this experiment is really a problem. Cardboard is not really a very nice material, but it's quite difficult to do better than it because the sliding coefficient of sliding friction is so high. I mean, it's essentially they're like gear wheels. They really are.
But are you saying it should be possible to find an experiment where this phenomenon you outlined between the difference between bulk and interior, the strain occurring in the bulk or in the wall region or the interior, it should be the same. It should be homogeneous for the smooth case.
That on the basis of periodic arrays, that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
And that's also if you put an emulsions hat on,
emulsions.
That's what people think in terms of.
Thank you. There must be others who have questions.
Do you think that it would be possible to do these experiments in a liquid if you have particles which range just above neutral buoyancy and low velocity? Especially in 3D, it might be a way of doing something similar.
Yes, sort of the hydrodynamics.
Well, that's
a whole new ball game.
Well, yeah, yes, but if they're nearly neutrally buoyant, then they'll be very close to that. They'll have very close to a constant fall velocity, and if they're low velocity, they won't have so much impact on the other particles. So you might have more of the hydrodynamics.
No, you can never ignore hydrodynamics when you have a densification process.
Well, you can if the particles have very low velocity. So that their actual volume, their effective rigid volume is large.
The problem is, you've got this, although the permeability will be significant, if the action's happening in a broad consolidation front, when it's all those forces, the permeability forces accumulate. The trouble, it's long range.
Yeah, yes, but it's what's important is the total volume that's occupied by the solid matter, but if the particles are extremely porous, then they still have a very low volume fraction of relation to the liquid. So if they were solid particles, it would fail, but if the fluid can move through the particles very easily, the long range interaction would remain weak.
Yes, so the problem is that if you look in a layer here, you see the outflow not just due to the consolidation of this sublayer here, but you see outflow from the consolidation of all of the points below you. So in practice, you get caught eventually. It's not an easy issue, but yes, in principle, I'm just slightly wary of the whole issue of fluid lubrication. For example, as you well know, I'm sure, in theory, it takes an infinite length of time to achieve contact between two spheres with a hydrodynamic fluid in between. And if you could, in practice, then become contact is achieved either due to austerities or due to jumped contact under diverging inter-surface forces. Now maybe the austerities case you'd say that's a winner because that's Coulomb friction.
And I have a question, maybe this might be for Jerry more than for you. I was thinking about how one would try to determine contact numbers experimentally, three dimensions. And if one has Hertzian forces, It would seem as though the fact that the resistivity of the contact is a nonlinear function of the load would suggest that you could, in fact, determine, you could deconvolve the number of contacts from the amount of load that was being carried by each contact.
You would, if each contact carried the same load, you could undoubtedly carry that out.
And
it's the dispersion of the loads that is going to make that difficult.
That's an experiment by Interpink.
Yeah, Bernal's experiment, yes. No, I have in mind to redo Bernal's experiment. Bernal filled bags with particles. And the experiment is more elegant than many people realize. You fill the bag with particles. Now, annoyingly, Bernal was interested in maximal packing, so he really shook and banged his bag. I wish he hadn't done that, but he did. Now, what happens is that if two particles are nearly touching, then the ink gets in like this. But it never you get trapped air there, and it never totally closes the gap. So you pour ink down, you let the ink drain out, you let the thing dry, and you open it up, and what happens from that is that you see a small open disc. And that's what, confusingly, Bernal calls a close contact, meaning an almost contact. If two particles literally touch, then what Bernal observed is the following. The ink fails to penetrate there like that. There's air trapped. But now it can diffuse along the surface, and it succeeds in getting that contact. And so what he finds for a true contact is a ring. Of unmarked material. But it is, I agree, it's a very, very elegant experiment.
Well, then what one wants to do is introduce a conductive fluid into one's packing and see how the conductivity changes in the amount of wetting fluid you're introducing, and try to
What Bernal just did it destructively. Yeah. It's just an incredibly messy, tedious experiment.
But non-destructive experiments are faster and easier.
Yeah, I can try. And there's another experiment. There is a 3D experiment I can tell you about. But let's let Jerry.
Well, I would just add that using electrical conductivity to measure contact areas has been done quite a lot in studies of friction.
Yes, but that doesn't give you a good contact count.
No, I understand. I understand.
Well, I mean, but why? I mean, we keep hearing about this exponential force scale, and that's pretty steep in the real world.
Yeah.
So, which would suggest that most contacts are carrying around the same force, and therefore have around the same area. So, if you measure the contact area, you get a number out that makes sense and can be correlated with the load, and can thus be correlated with the average coordination number. Since if you're in a gravitational system, you know what the load is. So, if you know what the load is per contact, you know how many contacts.
And you have a lot of disparity, so really any contact is a multiple contact.
Let me tell you what.
Well, that's why putting in the conductive fluid might be the trick that gets you up in length scale and gets you away from that kind of.
Actually, Thomas, conductive fluid, it's not all that helpful. I mean, I thought that by AC measurements you could get information on the distribution of near contact distances. But it turns out that if you have impedance dominated by what's in the gap, the conductance as you close the gap diverges only logarithmically. It's just too weak a dependence to be useful.
In terms of logarithmic in what?
In the gap.
No, I'm thinking about increasing the area.
Yeah.
Rather than the distance. So the one thing you have to be careful about, so you want conductive fluid that wets the surfaces but has a very thin wetting layer, so you don't create any new contact. So you want the wetting layer to be less than a nanometer or so. But then you want it to drain into where there are actual contacts.
Let me tell you an experiment we've tried at Warwick. I think it's got mileage, but I've learned the hard way that we need to go to large samples. And that's that you just make a box, 3D, two electrodes, and you put into this box, you just pour grains in, and some of your grains are conducting and some are not. And ideally, you seek to match all properties other than conductance between the two species. And since what you measure is simply the percolation threshold, the fraction of conducting grains at which you see percolation of those grains. Firstly, this is three dimensions, the spatially, the coordination numbers are quite high, so even a mean field fit to coordination number as a to FC as a function of coordination number of your spatial assembly is probably reasonable. But you can also, of course, just in the computer generate random packings, switch on a certain fraction of the contacts as being true mechanical contacts, switch on a certain fraction of the grains as being conducting, and make calibrating simulations. The limiting factor on it is actually just all of the finite size effect, and the fact that you think ball bearings are very, very cheap things to buy, and very easy things to paint, until you go shopping for them and you try painting them. That's what we use. We use ball bearings and painted ball bearings.
I think we should have a pause to allow people for whom this is no longer valuable discussion to leave.